Okay, Carol, are you ready?
Well, he may be on vacation now. I would be if I were in his job.
Good morning, gentlemen, ladies. I am convening today's House Revenue Committee. We have a second day on capital gains, proposed capital gains changes. I'm going to open all of the bills, so anyone who wants to speak can speak on any or all. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3420, House Bill 3282, House Bill 3283, House Bill 2562, House Bill 2730, and House Bill 3296. These all have a slightly different wrinkle than the last capital gains bills that we heard. And Chris, you want to tell us a little bit?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The six bills here, they do have that common theme of a more narrow focus, but just briefly, 2562 provides a personal and corporate subtraction that is currently blank for net capital gains reinvested in certain businesses. 2730 is identical to 2562, except it has a subtraction of up to $1 million, so rather than a blank, it specifies $1 million subtraction or a maximum subtraction of $1 million. 3282 provides a personal and corporate deferral of long-term capital gains if they are reinvested in an Oregon investment. House Bill 3283 reduces the personal and corporate capital gains tax rate to 5% if an equal amount is invested in an Oregon investment. House Bill 3296 provides a 50% personal and corporate subtraction of capital gains from the sale of a qualified business. And 3420 reduces the capital gains tax rate if an amount is invested as seed capital in an emerging growth business. We do have an amendment on the way for 3420. We're making copies right now, so we will have those very shortly. And generally, the bills are applicable for tax years 2011 and forward, except 3296 is 2012 forward, and 3420, at least as you have the introduced version, is a limited duration for tax years 2011 to 2014.
Questions for Chris from the committee? Representative Reed, do you want to go first? Because you're
sure.
Chief sponsor of one of these. And
Madam Chair, would you like me here?
Your choice.
Okay. Well, I'll stay here then. House Bill 3420 is the one that probably deserves more explanation. Chris accurately points out 2730 and 2562 are the same. 3420 is a little bit of a different approach. We start with, there's a statutory definition of emerging growth business already, which says it's an individual or group of individuals or new or small company, including but not limited to, and it has a few definitions, says that has the capacity upon obtaining appropriate capital to generate significant high-skill, high-wage employment. So that's what we're after. And 3420 offers a discounted capital gains rate on gains that are realized as a result of investments in those businesses if the investment is made in a specified time period, sort of the special opportunity. If investments were to occur in that type of business now, these Dash 2 amendments might be headed your way, and it specifies that the discount would be on a tier. The Business Development Commission could identify targeted sector industries, key sector industries, and critical sector industries, each of which would have a discount from the normal rate of 10, 15, and 25% respectively. So the idea, of course, is to provide a little extra motivation for investments in emerging growth businesses and leave it to the Business Development Department to determine the targeted key and critical sector industries. We've had some initial help from Chris to identify the revenue impact of this approach. It's somewhat hard, and I'd certainly let Chris talk about his methodology, but there, capital gains, of course, being among the very most volatile of our sources, hard to predict, also hard to predict how much of those would be in the emerging growth businesses, but he's offered a few scenarios, the most of which would be a $16 million revenue impact and I submit it for your consideration amongst the other options that are on the table today.
I have a few questions. Anyone want to... what do you envision as the kind of companies that are targeted, key, or critical sectors? I'm trying to get at what you're thinking.
Madam Chair, my thinking is that we'd want to, I can imagine two scenarios. One, a selection of industries that are important for our ability as a state to do the things we want to do generally, to respond to the needs of our citizens and so on. Alternatively, or perhaps on the same level, industries that have growth potential based on our competitive advantages, the kinds of things you and I are familiar with from Oregon Inc., where there are opportunities and where there are needs probably is the shortest summary.
Another question. You have an emerging growth company. I'm trying to get at the timing of this bill. If you invest in it, the year you invest in it is when you realize the capital gains reduction, or you get it when the business grows and your capital gains, you understand the timing issue?
Absolutely.
Madam
Chair, the latter. So invest in this window. And then later on, if you were to realize a gain, it would be at the discounted rate.
Got it. And the discount is the 10%, the 15, and the 20.
From the normal rate, that's right.
Okay.
And of course, Madam Chair, I should go without saying I'm very open to amendments on any of these things.
Okay. I was just trying to get at what the concept is. Further questions on this concept? One other thing. The Oregon Business Development Commission then would, by rule, decide what the criteria for these, and then would have the authority to say before you invest whether it fit into those criteria, so the investor would know ahead of time.
Correct, Madam Chair. They would certify that this is an emerging growth business and therefore eligible for the discount should there be gains at a future date.
And then it's envisioned that they would decertify them at some point. In other words, a business isn't, I mean, after it's emerged, it's not emerging. It's sort of the Betsy issue when is it fully emerged?
I think, Madam Chair, the question would be confined to the time at which an investment were made.
Because so, it's limited in this bill.
That's right. And if at any point, I think a person who's contemplating an investment in what they think would be an emerging growth business and wanting to take advantage of this would go to the Business Development Department and find out. So if at some time the business is no longer deemed to be an emerging growth business, the potential investor would get that word back. They're no longer in that class, so you don't get this discount if you choose to invest.
Thank you, Representative. That's an intriguing idea, and I'm pleased to see thinking outside the box. Any other questions for Representative Reed? We have Steve Buckstein has signed up for House Bill 3296, or all of these are open, Steve, so you can speak to any others if you care to.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Barnhart and Berger, or Berger and Barnhart, I guess you're running this today, and members of the committee. I'm Steve Buckstein, Senior Policy Analyst and Founder at Cascade Policy Institute, a public policy research organization in Portland, who's, as you know, but for the world, whose mission is to promote individual liberty, personal responsibility, and economic opportunity in Oregon. I'm here to testify in favor of reducing or eliminating Oregon's capital gains tax rate in general. I signed up for one bill. I wasn't sure if you were dealing with them all at once, but the concept in general. I think you already know people from all sides of the political spectrum, I think, agree from the governor on down that targeted at least targeted, if not general, reductions in capital gains rates are good for the economy, can grow the economy, can create jobs. And so that's why I think all these bills are on the table. You're looking for ways to create jobs in Oregon and boost the economy, which is a good thing. I am not, however, a fan of targeted capital gains rate reductions in general. If that's all we get, it might be better than nothing, but I have a real problem with the legislature or the government or any agency of the state picking winners and losers who should get capital gains reductions and who shouldn't. At least a few years ago, I haven't seen the updated information, but about three-quarters of the capital gains taken in Oregon are by middle-class people, not by rich investors, people earning under $100,000 or reporting income to the state of under $100,000 a year. They won't benefit from any of these targeted capital gains tax reductions, as far as I can tell. You're aiming for people that have a lot of capital, that are willing to take risks, and that's fine. But I think you'll get the same and better effect by simply reducing the capital gains tax rate as much as you can and letting the market decide, letting people in Oregon, whether they're wealthy investors, whether they're business people who live here or people who are contemplating coming here and starting businesses, let them decide if they invest in Oregon businesses or if they invest elsewhere. If they're living here, you're going to get other economic benefits from them. They're probably, if they're moving here as investors, they're probably high-income individuals. You're going to be getting that revenue from them. And so reducing their capital gains, even if they make investments outside Oregon, I think is a good thing. I have a particular concern on the first bill that was heard about. I agree it's thinking outside the box, but I'm afraid in some cases the box is there for a reason. Defining what is an emerging business is going to be very difficult. You're going to get people who are going to shut down their business, start a brand new one with the same, you know, the same activities to call it emerging. You're going to be getting scams. You're going to be getting all kind of things that I think you're not, the unintended consequences that economists are very well aware of when you set conditions on these kind of things. So I would be concerned about that. If you just have a general reduction for investing in quote unquote an Oregon business, that's maybe less subject to those kind of scams, but still, I don't think you need to do that. I think simply reducing the capital gains, I know there's, in a static model, you're going to see a fiscal impact, you're going to see a reduction, but the time to reduce or eliminate the capital gains tax rate is when there aren't any capital gains, and there haven't been many capital gains recently. As you heard and you know, capital gains is the most volatile segment of the Oregon tax structure. The rate, the amount of income you received, or the percentage of the state revenue dropped precipitously in the recession, and it could even go negative in another recession because of tax loss carry forwards. You could be in a position where, with Oregon having the highest capital gains tax rate in the country now, at least currently at 11%, with a huge reduction in the market, you could be looking at owing those people money from tax loss carry forwards. You could have a negative capital gains income for the state. So while capital gains income is, it's true. If you talk to Paul Warner, I think he's, that was an earlier discussion with the tax restructuring task force. If there are basically no capital gains and people are carrying forward, what is it, $3,000 a year in tax losses, you could actually have negative. You could actually see money flowing out of state coffers because of the capital gains tax. It hasn't happened yet. Hopefully it never happens, but it could happen. So the time to, again, reduce or eliminate Oregon's capital gains tax is when there aren't many, when there aren't hardly any. We were dependent almost entirely recently on Phil Knight's sale of Nike, which is about as unpredictable as the state can probably predict. So simply reduce it in general, I think, is the way to go. You'll create jobs. You'll boost the economy. You'll send a signal to investors and business people everywhere, in Oregon and outside Oregon, that Oregon is trying to attract investment. If they invest in Oregon businesses, that's great. But if they simply come here, bring their capital here, and invest elsewhere, I think that's still great. You're still attracting people that are investing in business. They don't have to move when they sell their business, which, as you know, happens, I think, too often. They move across the river to Vancouver or whatever to avoid our capital gains tax. Why even risk that if you can avoid it? And rather than picking winners and losers, just do it across the board. So that's my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? I actually have one. Your three-fourths of capital gains are from taxpayers who file it under $100,000.
Not the total, excuse me, Madam Chair, of the actual, the number of people who take capital gains. Obviously, their capital gains are much smaller. If I'm invested in a mutual fund and I get a report of a capital gain of $1,000, you know, that's a capital gain. It doesn't compare to the ones you're talking about in terms of dollar value. I'm not sure what the breakdown is dollar volume-wise, but there are a lot of middle-class Oregonians who, in good economic times, do pay capital gains taxes. And these bills, as I understand it, probably wouldn't help any of them.
So what you're saying is three-fourths of filers have a capital gains component?
No. Three-fourths of the capital gains, I'm not sure how to put it. If you have,
I want you to put it right, but I want you to tell me where you get the figure.
I've got, we'll give you the report.
Actually, most of that information, I think, is in basic facts.
Well, yeah. I'm trying to get at what he's saying.
Of 1,000 people who pay capital gains taxes to Oregon, and this was several years ago, I'm not sure the current number, three-fourths of those, or 76.4%, I think it was, in that year, report income to the state, total income to this taxable income of under $100,000. Now, their capital gains may be, as an example, $1,000, and the few outliers may be in the millions of dollars.
Right.
You know,
we're not talking about the amounts. We're talking about
the number of people. Number of people. And so what I'm saying is that the majority of people that pay capital gains taxes are not high income individuals.
And I'm just asking if you'd email the reference.
I will. Yeah. It is in the state. I think I can't remember.
It is in the basic facts.
Yeah.
Okay.
Madam Chair, on that topic, he did misspeak earlier, and I heard it too, but I didn't remember it when it came time to question. The issue, of course, is what's the denominator and what specific item are you talking about? When you're talking about number of taxpayers, the amount doesn't count. We're not talking about that. If you have 2 cents of capital gains, you're one of those taxpayers. The reality is, of course, the vast, vast, vast amount of capital gains are taken by very wealthy people.
I agree, Co-Chair Barnhart. Again, but that doesn't make the people with the 2 cent capital gain feel any better when they're taxed at a higher rate than the wealthy person who can take advantage of the loopholes, as I would call them, that you're talking about creating here.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming down. Anyone else signed up?
Did you have a question for him?
No.
She has bills.
I have.
Yeah.
Two bills.
Why don't you talk about the bills and then we'll have you come up.
Okay.
If whatever your preference.
I think I'll do that.
Representative Brewer is sponsor of a number of these bills.
Madam Chair and Committee, thank you. Allow me to come in late, kind of doing double duty this morning.
And your name?
My name is Representative Katie Air Brewer, House District 29.
Thank you.
Thank you. And sitting member of this esteemed wonkish committee, which I'm learning more and more. I love it. I'm presenting House Bill, or sponsored House Bill 3282 and 3283, and these are just two more opportunities to skin this capital gains cat. What we have here in Oregon is a very high unilaterally imposed tax rate. We don't have any tiered structuring based on character of income. So regardless of the character of income, we have our income tax rate. The federal government, of course, breaks out their rates. They have their ordinary income tax, they have their capital gains tax, and they have their AMT tax, and they have various other types of taxing strata for income. And I can tell you as a tax practitioner that folks are very much motivated by capital gains rate. It will impact how they structure a sale of assets, how the timing of a structure of assets, depending on what the assets are. And they are motivated by that. And I can tell you, we saw that with the revenue forecast. And I, In December, we had a lot of folks, taxpayers, that had capital gain assets, capital assets with a gain there, that were getting ready to sell them in 2010 because 2011 federal rate was scheduled to go up by 5% from 15 to 20. When they were given new tax on December, a lot of them deferred the sale of their capital transaction until, I'm assuming, first quarter of 2011. And so that just shows the motivation there. So for me, my esteemed colleague from Cascade Policy, I understand the free market and allowing the market to choose where to send their money. As a tax practitioner, I would want my clients to have the lowest capital gain rate available. As a legislator, though, I have to kind of curtail it a bit. When I look at where we are economically as a state, I would like to have a lower capital gains tax rate for our taxpayers in Oregon. But the fact that someone sells an asset at a gain matters very little to me as a legislator. What matters to me is what they do with the cash. And so my two bills bring us to that point. And my two bills require reinvestment in Oregon business in order to receive a concession on the tax rate. One, 3283 actually allows a 5% capital gains rate to the extent that the gain has been reinvested in Oregon businesses. 3282 takes a different tact to the extent that it's actually reinvested in an Oregon business. It actually allows a deferral of the gain, and those are two different things. And the deferral means that we will capture that gain at some point in the future and tax it versus recognizing it now at a lower rate. And those are simply the two differences in those bills, and the goal of the bills is to capture the dollars into Oregon business and continue to create jobs and our prosperity. One thing I do want to point out, though, I take a little bit of a different perspective than what Chair Barnhart said about it. It's overwhelmingly the wealthy that have capital gains. Potentially, people with capital gains or people that have maybe had an asset that is appreciated like a farmer, but they haven't had the cash to go with it. A wealth is a term that can be used or misused, and wealth doesn't mean liquid cash. It doesn't mean the ability to live a high life. Wealth might mean just simply asset rich but cash poor. And finally, you do dispose of your assets for whatever purposes. And I want to reiterate, just to clarify, capital gain is triggered on capital assets, on the sale of capital assets at a profit. And capital assets can be what we think of as intangible assets, such as stock and other types of things like that. And those are sourced to the state of residency. And when we have an individual with a capital asset that's intangible and they tee up, let's say they've started a company and they're getting ready to sell the stock and they tee up to sell it, they very easily can move out of state to Washington, pay no state capital gains tax on it, and Oregon misses out on all opportunities for that. What we also have are capital assets that are not intangible assets. Those are business assets, such as their real property that they've had invested, or business assets that they've sold, or they've created they've created an ongoing business with ongoing assets in there, and instead of choosing to sell the stock of their company or their partnership interest, they choose to sell their assets of their business. And those, when that capital transaction happens, the capital gain is sourced to the location of those assets in general. I mean, there's some tweaking on that. So I want to move away from the fact that capital gain is only triggered upon capital intangible assets such as stock. This is not something that impacts only the wealthy. It impacts every small business person out there who, in all likelihood, whenever selling their business, will sell the assets and not the stock. Or if they sell the stock, they'll treat it as an asset sale through another federal provision. So this is an opportunity. My two bills are meant to raise the conversation to, one, either lower the rate, or two, offer a deferral on gain to the extent reinvested back into Oregon. And I think both of them have merit. I know that there's many other bills trying to get to the same goal as well. I just am grateful that we're having the discussion and give it good opportunity for planning. And that's it.
Questions for Representative Brewer?
I have a couple.
Thank you.
The deferral, I haven't. Representative Brewer.
Yes, down there.
Yeah, either one.
I thought there were no questions.
No, I have a couple. Yeah. The deferral.
Yes, ma'am.
How long and how is that managed? In other words, what's your vision for that deferral piece?
The deferral
is it the amount of capital gain at the 11% rate that you would have had is deferred because to, I mean, how does that work?
Let me just read the bill to make sure I'm going to talk about the gross amount or the, thank you, Madam Chair, for the question. So the deferral is on the gain. So the amount of the gain, Madam Chair, the amount of the gain must be deferred. And we actually provide in here for the Department of Revenue to be able to generate the filing requirements necessary. This, to me, is akin to it's not a Section 1031-like kind exchange, but it's akin to that in the reporting. And as long as the what this bill contemplates is allowing the deferral of the gain into a new business, and if that business is then deferred, that can happen as well, but they must continue to meet the requirements of a defer, of reinvesting back in Oregon businesses.
Okay, and both of these talk about in Oregon businesses.
Yes.
And I haven't read them either, so there's a definition of Oregon businesses for this purpose, and what would that be?
Yeah, Oregon, it talks in here about the meaning in ORS 470.050, and I will tell you the way that these are drafted is that I do believe they need to be tweaked in Oregon businesses. For example, there should be some discussion as to whether we mean Oregon business assets, Oregon business enterprise level of stock or LLC interest, things like that, but we must further tweak that. But I do leave it open.
Okay. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for the bill, Representative Brewer. I was thinking about the deferral, particularly part of the conversation that motivated 2730 for me. Was the result of stories I heard about a deferral program that had been undertaken in the 90s. So I'll share a little scenario that I heard about and see how you react to it. Sounded like what was tried in the 90s was intended to be a rollover but ended up being enacted as a deferral. So if someone made an investment at time zero, got to a gain, realized the gain, subsequently reinvested in something else, it ends up so that the gain is captured at that point. The subsequent investment ends up losing value, so that the at the end when there's not a subsequent reinvestment, the investor's position is at or below the original basis, and at that point the tax is assessed from the gain. So the investor. Felt in the scenario that was described to me, like it was not realistic that they have experienced a loss in total, but then owe tax on the gain that had happened some time ago. So what was described to me was that ended up having a chilling effect on that program, and not very many people ended up using it. So can you help me through thinking how that might or might not happen in your?
It actually can. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Reed. It actually can continue to happen. There is an opportunity in the future when the business goes away, it's liquidated. They have less basis because they've deferred this gain in. They have less basis. They may, in fact, though, potentially, depending on the parameters of what happens, they may, in fact, on that losing business, have an offsetting loss that can be applied against the gain that's coming forward. The one thing, though, not to lose sight of, from our perspective as a state, in the meantime that we have had, in that time period while the investor taking the entrepreneurial risk is there, and part of their entrepreneurial risk would be the deferral of the tax gain and knowing that they potentially have a liability there to pay, in the meantime, we have now created jobs. We have now created more investment in Oregon through this entrepreneurial risk. So that taxpayer continues to be at risk, but it is their choice and their entrepreneurial risk, and hopefully we end up better as a state for it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, you're off the hook.
Thank you.
Sorry. Okay. Lori, would you like to come and speak to us? All the bills are open.
Good morning, co-chairs and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing the Oregon Education Association. I also serve as the chair and co-founder of the Oregon Revenue Coalition, which represents over 100 organizations and individuals who follow tax policy and the wonky committees of the building. And though I am neither a CPA nor a lawyer, I'm going to take a crack at this, especially after a previous witness said that everyone agrees that this is the way to stimulate investment, and we would respectfully disagree with that analysis. You have my written testimony. I won't read it to you, but I do want to hit several of the high points. We do see this as a tax break for the affluent that Oregon can ill afford with a $3.5 billion revenue shortfall and a grim future ahead in terms of cuts to education and other vital services. If the goal is job creation, this is not a reliable tool. Research shows that it does not necessarily guarantee economic stimulus, job creation, or business development incentives. There's even a question of whether an Oregon-only capital gains favorable rate would be constitutional under the Interstate Commerce Clause. Finally, there's no way to ensure that labor-related investing is what the outcome would be of any capital gains tax cut. I use in my written testimony the example of someone who buys creates a car wash in Oregon, for example. If it's a hand wash, car wash, it maybe employs 10 people. If you give a capital gains tax cut, perhaps the owner, with the idea of driving down labor costs, invests in increased mechanization, thereby needing only 3 employees to run it. Your Oregon-only capital gains tax cut has therefore reduced jobs by 70% in that particular investment. It's a plausible scenario. We've seen it with many industries in Oregon over time. If you do ultimately move forward on some sort of capital gains favorable tax treatment, however, we ask you to do so carefully and to ask yourself, what should the quid pro quo be for the state's significant loss of revenue as a result of this action? How will we be assured as Oregonians that good jobs will result from the benefits inducement to making qualified investments? What recourse will the state have if a taxpayer does not invest as required but claims the cut nevertheless? We believe that Oregonians expect good stewardship of their public wealth. It would be bad stewardship to offer this tax break without a structural guarantee of accountability and transparency. With this thought, we suggest that you consider the following features to any tax break you might contemplate: a reporting, certification, tracking, or enforcement process, sanctions, including clawback provisions tied to the rate cut, corporate disclosure, incentives to target investment in areas of the state hardest hit by our economic decline, a demonstration by taxpayers that the qualifying investments do create jobs at Oregon's prevailing wage level, so that it's economically efficient on a cost-per-job basis, and that any rate reduction be tied to the successful package of kicker reform at the ballot box. And finally, and this is a most important point to us, if we truly want to say with a straight face that a capital gains tax cut is meant to induce economic stimulus and create jobs, we ought to reward investments made subsequent to the enactment and effective date of the rate cut. So that is prospective reward for investing. If you reward past investing, that is not inducing investment. So we believe that it should at least be made prospective. Even the most modest of the revenue impact capital gains tax cuts we've heard of, the $25 million impact in the next biennium, is the equivalent of 267 teaching jobs in Oregon. And as we're about to lay off thousands of teachers in this state in the coming biennium, we would ask you to keep that in mind, that this tax cut could very well be characterized as something that gives favorable tax treatment to the wealthy few while Oregon's teachers are being laid off and students are coping with shortened school years and higher class sizes. We know this committee hopes to help find a strategy to induce investment and job creation to put more of our people back to work, and we want that too. But as one wise person once said, hope is not a strategy. We need a proven job creation strategy in Oregon, not just wishful thinking. Thank you.
Questions for Lori?
Thank you. Do we have anyone else to sign up?
Anyone else in the back of the room? Mr. Craven.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Craven, representing Tech America. I'm not here to counter anything that's been said. Just to work a little bit off my memory, which is not so good as it used to be. I worked on the bill in the 90s that Representative Reed was talking about, and though it's sort of a distant, faint memory, just one caution that I remember from working through that bill, that was the deferral. We characterized it at the time as a sort of the way homeowners used to be. You know, you had to roll over your gain in your house, and you could defer taxes, not fail to pay them. And the scenario Representative Reed brought up is a good one. But my memory of having worked that bill with Governor Kitzhaber last time was sort of a caution about what happens sometimes in this hearing room. So I recall we had a bill, and it was pretty thoughtful bill. It got scored with a revenue estimate, and we were informed that it was unacceptable to the governor. It was too high a number, and, I mean, you all know how that happens. So we went back, and we tweaked it and changed it and changed the holding period and changed the deferral and changed how long you could do something. We kind of whittled away at it with the main goal, the revenue estimate number, till we got it to a level where the governor said he would sign that version. That version went into effect. I think it had a 4-year sunset. It was a short period of sort of a trial, and very few taxpayers did take advantage of it. It's hard to ever, in retrospect, figure out why that is. But from the proponent for the bill, who was a prominent Portland lawyer and worked a lot with startup companies and entrepreneurs, his frank assessment to me was that we kind of goofed it up in focusing on the revenue estimate rather than on the policy that we intended, with the result that nobody used it, so we decided that was a bad idea. So I don't recall all the details involved in that, but it's just sort of a cautionary tale that sometimes we get things too complicated for good reasons, because we do have to worry about balancing the budget and revenues and such. But when we're doing something prospective about hoping to encourage behavior, if we get too complicated in trying to micromanage it, sometimes the result is that investors and taxpayers say, no, thank you. I'll wait for a better deal. So I just wanted to throw that out, and it's a very small tale, and but that's my recollection of the last time we tried this approach, was that we tried and we came up with something and people said it didn't work, and then we let it sunset, and so here we are today. So anyway, wish you best of luck in trying to do this again. So that's all I wanted to add today.
Thank you, Mr. Craven. Questions? Yes,
thank you, Madam Chair. Simply a comment. I think your cautionary tale is well taken, and we have to remember, of course, that when we adopt a tax policy, it's got to be one that's practical in the real world as well as practical in the ethereal world of tax policy. Thank you,
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you. Anyone else? Come on in, John.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen here as the co-chair of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon Tax and Revenue Committee. I just simply want to testify and say that we are also members of the Revenue Coalition, and I think you've heard a lot of things here this morning that give pause as you contemplate what it is that you're trying to accomplish, both from a policy perspective and also as we look at it in the Human Services Coalition about what could potentially be the net job effect if we wind up having reductions elsewhere in the budget. In the human services world, we're very well aware of the fact that the jobs that are created or maintained also often have federal matching dollars, and so there's an impact there as well. So we simply know that there's a lot of discussions about capital gains, the tie to the kicker and rainy day fund discussion, very complex discussions. At the same time, I just can't help but note, I'll be at PCC Sylvania media tonight as the testimony happens, the opening testimony for the Ways and Means Roadshow, where we'll hear testimony after testimony of people who are really suffering during this economy. And as we think about the people who are really in need, I know that that has to be balanced out as you look at things like tax policy. But again, I simply want to say that we want to underscore the testimony given by Lori as members of the Revenue Coalition. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. Yes, Representative Benz.
I should have asked this question of everyone that's testified. Thank you, Madam Chair. The question is, what do we do to attract investment to this state? If not this tool, what other tool? And I asked that question a month ago, and the answer wasn't particularly helpful, so I'm hoping you might have one.
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, I think this is an issue that's eluded any number of people and in fact, a number of state governments as they look at ways in which they can attract and retain business. I had three graduate-level courses in economics enough to thoroughly confuse me about issues about things like where businesses locate and how they're interested in issues like tax policy and livability. I think the thing that is strongest about Oregon, and I'm not a native Oregonian, but I've lived here since 1975, is the quality of life that we have here. And the quality of life is also the factors that lead to it are things like education and the kinds of services that are available in the state. So I think these issues are complex, and I wish I had a simple answer for you, or even a satisfactory answer, Representative Benz, because I think that is something that's a challenge to all of you as you think about how do we have the proper kind of environment that will attract and retain businesses. So, again, I apologize that I don't have a precise answer.
Follow up?
Yes.
I'm happy to wait until this afternoon so you can email it.
I'll do a lot of thinking before then.
Thank you, and thank you for coming. I will kind of take the chair's prerogative to say that quality of life in Oregon, those of us in this room and in this state understand how wonderful this state is. But I think that we'd all agree that a vigorous job base is one of the things that would add substantially to our quality of life by employing the Oregonians. And those of us who think our capital gains rate is too high believe that it is tied to that vigorous job growth and that vigorous private sector development that we think is essential in order to have the wherewithal to hire more teachers and strengthen our social service piece. So I think we're not arguing over the goal. We're arguing over how to get there. And so I appreciate all of you who have come and engaged in this dialogue. It will be ongoing. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3420, House Bill 3282, House Bill 3283, House Bill 2562, House Bill 2730, House Bill 3296, and adjourn today's Revenue Committee hearing.